we go. Y'all ready for this? The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. This is a law show, a law talk show. Gary Bell, Brad Pollock. We are injury attorneys in our day lives, but right here on this radio show, we're here for you to answer your question on any legal subject that you want. The telephone number is 303-713-8255. Tell me what the following is from. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Where's that from? What's that from? The First Amendment, the United States Constitution. Today we're going to talk a little bit about the issues with regard to Palm Ridge High School, the editorial published by the paper, The Bare Truth, Freedom of Speech, the First Amendment, the United States Constitution. We talk law on this show. We don't talk politics. So we're going to try to drive down and drill down and to see what happens. Where did this all this law come from? What happened to the law? How did we get to the statute in Colorado? How does it relate to free speech? And, you know, we have the Colorado Student Freedom of Expression Law. It was enacted in 1990. It's been on the books for a long time. Today we're going to talk to a little bit to the lady who was instrumental in getting that statute passed after the Hazelwood decision. So this is a fascinating legal subject. A lot of people mad on one side, a lot of people mad on the other side. So this is not a political show. It's a law talk show. The First Amendment talks about freedom of press and freedom of speech, Brad. But when you get into the school environment, there are some changes. And so we're going to give you a little bit of history of how this came about. So overall, if you don't like a statute, if you didn't like this statute, if you don't like the way the statute's applied, how can it be attacked? How can it be supported? What are the pros and cons of this statute? And one of the ways it can be attacked is any law that's passed by a state that restricts, listen to this very carefully, restricts the United States Constitution is attackable. Doesn't mean it's going to be sustained or that argument's going to win, but if it restricts it, but if it expands and gives more protection to a constitutionally guaranteed right like freedom of press, if it expands it, then it's less attackable, in attorney's words. Kind of a legal mumble jumble, but how do you declare a statute to be unconstitutional? So, Brad, in the school environment, and there's been this big controversy with regard to the Bare Truth editorial. In the school environment, we first had, we got the United States Constitution, but then we had the case of, Tinker versus Des Moines, and that dealt with the students wearing armbands protesting the Vietnam War. So how do we come from there to this point?
Well, it's been a long and tortured road, from what I can tell, as far as what's happened. We face the situation where, as in Tinker versus Des Moines, the Supreme Court ruled that it can hardly be argued that either students or teachers shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech at the schoolhouse gate. However, there has to be a balancing test. And, you know, when you stop and look at our Constitution, you look at the rights that are given to people, that's something that goes on just about all the time when we're dealing with the Constitution as a balancing test. And in this particular thing, we have a balancing test. Where does the major purpose of school to educate balance or become subject to or overrule one's right to freedom of expression or freedom of speech? And Tinker was talking about freedom of expression, which is a form of freedom of speech. It said that you don't shed your rights when you walk into the school. And so in Tinker, it started talking about with reasonable restraints, really, the school people in public schools now. When you go into a public school, you have the right to have certain freedom of speech and freedom of expression.
Right. And, you know, and then the question becomes, how can the school control or can they control the freedom of expression, the freedom of speech, or the freedom of press? Because it was created a big controversy on the Bare Truth. So we're going to drill down a little bit further on this particular case and subject. So can they control it under the Tinker case? That was decided in 1969 by the United States Supreme Court. They said that the students wearing armbands protesting the Vietnam War, that was the issue. Could they do that? And were they allowed to do that? And so the Tinker Court essentially extended the First Amendment protection to certain categories like the armbands. So what are the dividing line? What's the definition of how a school can control this? after the Tinker case, Bud, we have the Hazelwood case.
Sure.
And so let's talk a little bit about the Hazelwood case.
Well, first, just remember in Tinker, they ruled that it was okay to have freedom of expression and freedom of right. And the restraint or the major restraint was whether or not one could reasonably forecast that the expression that was being done in Tinker or any expression will cause a substantial disruption of school activities or would invalidate the rights of others. Once again, you got a balancing. Is it going to disrupt the school activities or invalidate the rights of others? As time went on, you know, this had to get a more clear definition. And then what happened is in Hazelwood School District versus Q Miller in 1988, they came out and they started talking about whether or not high schools had a greater authority to censor school-sponsored student publications if they chose to do so. And what was the right to sponsor, or I mean, I'm sorry, to censor those publications? Once again, they said that there had to be some reasonable justification, some reasonable educational justification before you could sponsor it, before you could censor anything. And so it was a nebulous concept again, because they're talking about still, what's the major purpose in the school? You have to have education. Are you going to be, you know, and you've got to remember that the Supreme Court has always tried to strike out a situation where you cannot be vulgar, you can't do certain things that would be offensive as far as inappropriate conduct. But the real question was, is could they censor anything? And the Supreme Court said, you've got a public forum for student expression. And because you have that public forum for student expression, you had to then determine whether or not there was a reasonable educational justification to censor the material. That's
right.
Kind of a nebulous concept.
It is. Well, okay, so we had Tinker in 1969 by the United States Supreme Court, the armed bands protesting the Vietnam War, and the holding. Then came Hazelwood. Later, it was 1988. Hazelwood basically said, in English language, that said if the school can say, the school can control the content and the style of any kind of speech or press there in the school as long as it relates to legitimate educational concerns. And so that was more a little bit more restriction and outlined the fact that the school officials could control this. And so then right after the 1988 decision, there was an action or a movement in Colorado to pass a statute for this student free expression is what I'll call it. There's a name of the statute. And that's what the statute deals with on student editorials and student newspapers. And so right after the break, we got a lady coming up who was instrumental in passing the statute in Colorado with regard to student expressions, student free speech, student free press, and what is the real legal deal with this editorial. And we're talking law here this morning. Gary Bell, Brad Pollack. Our law firm is Bell and Pollack. We are injury attorneys in our day lives and our radio lives. We're right here for you. The telephone number is 303-713-8255. And in the mountains, it's 970-870-8989. And I'll tell you what, anytime, any place, go to our website, championsofthepeople.com. It's an information loaded website. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Bell and Pollack Legal Show. We're talking law. Today we're talking about the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. We're talking about the Colorado Student Freedom of Expression Law enacted by the legislature in Colorado in 1990. And right now we're going to talk to Marta Hetty, who was a lady who was instrumental in getting the statute passed right after the Hazelwood decision. Good morning, Marta. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Wonderful. So I got a couple of questions for you. You know, when Hazelwood was passed, that was in 1988, and it, you know, it basically said that if there was any expression or press in school environment, that if it interfered with their basic educational mission, they could control the content and the style. And so then I think at or about that time, you were president of the Colorado High School Press Association. Am I right?
Well, at that point, I was vice president, but I was very active, yes.
Then you later became president, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so then I think you were instrumental in getting this statute passed for students on the free press. So give us a little bit of what you went through and how that worked there.
Well, as soon as the Hazelwood ruling came down, the Press Association started getting word from advisors all over the state about censorship issues. But for the most part, they were pretty ridiculous. There was an opinion piece written in one newspaper criticizing a mandatory study hall policy, and that was censored by the principal, even though an editorial supporting the policy was printed on the same page. The principal didn't want anything negative about his new policy. There was a photo of a flamingo painted on a dumpster that was censored in a story because the administrators thought that it made graffiti look attractive. It went all the way from political issues in the school to the principal's agenda. Kids were told to write, kids at one newspaper were told to write positive things about the upcoming budget questions. So we kept getting reports about all of those things, and we did a little research. We knew that Iowa had a law on the books protecting student freedom of expression. California, kids researched there and discovered that they, too, had a law on the books. Massachusetts tried to pass a law. The first year that Hazelwood came out, they failed. They tried again the next year. They were the third state to put freedom of expression on the books. And then in 89, we went to work on our law and got it passed in 1990.
Right. When I talked to you off the air, when I interviewed you before the show yesterday, you were talking a little bit about this statute. So Hazelwood in 1988 was probably the catalyst for the statute to go forward, but this Hazelwood decision basically said the school could control the content and style of press if it related or if it was inconsistent with their educational policy. So this statute was passed, but this is not a political show. But I did ask you the question: how did you get it going? I think you said you had bipartisan support when you started getting the statute ready to go.
Yes, Senator Pat Pascoe, who is a Democrat. Was the original sponsor of the bill, and shortly after that, Representative Jeannie Adkins from Castle Rock, who's a Republican and had been a journalist, signed on as co-sponsor. So we had bipartisan support from the beginning.
All right, very good. And then there's eight states that have a similar law now, and this law was enacted in Colorado. And I think you told me it went on the first reading or something like that. What did you say?
Yeah, we passed our law on the first year that we tried to get it passed. Many states have struggled for years and never been able to pass, and other states tried two or three times and then eventually got it passed.
Okay, so the statute applies to public schools. It doesn't apply to private schools.
True.
Right. So I just thought it would be interesting for everybody to hear the lady who was instrumental in getting this thing passed. You then became president of the Colorado High School Press Association, now known as the Colorado Student Media Association. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Marta, we really appreciate your input. Thank you for being on the show this morning, and thank you for your efforts.
Okay.
All right. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show, Gary Bell, Brad Pollock. We're here for you. We're ready to talk law. This is a law talk show. We're talking about the First Amendment today. Right now, we're going to talk to Martin and Glenn. We'll get to you. Robert, we'll get to you. Larry, we'll get to you. Martin, good morning.
Good morning. I guess you really can't mention insurance in a courtroom.
Right. Can't mention insurance. You've been listening to our other shows, have you?
Yeah, but isn't that right? Isn't your First Amendment?
It has to be. It's restricted. That's a rule of evidence, a rule of law. Yeah, sure. Sure. Of course.
Actually, my question is regarding calculation of damages.
Okay.
And do people who are plaintiffs that are victims of injuries, automobile accidents, et cetera, is there a certain percentage that end up bankrupt because they can't really hold their head above water regarding their medical payments? And is that considered part of their damages?
All right. So, when you say damages, what are you talking about specifically? I'm not sure I understand your
question. Economic damages, because now they're unable really to sustain any kind of income, jobs, et cetera, because their medical problems really prohibit that.
Right. I mean, that's part of their economic damages. Your economic damages are one element of your damages in a court of law. In an injury case, of course, there are other elements of damages, but then nobody can ever know about insurance, as you mentioned at the outset.
Sure.
But economic damages, and it depends. I mean, sometimes if you're a wage earner, then if you haven't worked for 6 months, then it's easier to calculate your losses because you made X dollars per hour for so much money per week, and then you haven't worked for 6 months. That's easier.
When you start getting behind on your mortgage payments, you're now in danger of losing your home.
Well, yeah, you're in danger of losing your home, and the sad thing is, many times the people have to wait for justice, wait for their trial, or wait for a settlement, and they have to figure out a way to be sustained until the trial comes to fruition, or money's paid, or they have the verdict from the jury. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very legitimate question that you have to wait, and delays many times favors the insurance company who tries to defeat and beat these claims.
Or if that person's really trying to flip the home that they're in, because now they're trying to ride the crest of home prices that are going sky high in certain areas, and they're trying to maximize their retirement money that they're banking on their home would bring.
Right.
And now they're missing the window of opportunity, because now the home was only half done or half refurbished.
Right. Unless...
Because they can't work on it, plus any kind of money they do have is going to medical payments.
Right.
Those are damages, Martin, that you really can't bring up in the court. That, you know, they're a type of consequential damages, but they're just damages that you can't bring up in a court. They're not going to let you try and get. They're considered too remote about what you would have or could have done with the money, where you could have taken advantage of a great investment, or where you could have taken advantage of I had a chance to buy this stock, or I had a chance to get involved in the ground floor of this business. And, you know, a lot of times a case takes a couple of years to get to trial. You look and say, look at the great deal, or look at the great benefits, or the great money I could have made if I had gotten in on the ground floor of a certain stock. I could have been at Chipotle. I could have bought the stock in them when they first came out. I couldn't because of my injuries, because of all the money I'd lost. And the courts just aren't going to let you go that
because
far.
It just hasn't occurred yet.
Right, right. They're going to make it more a chain of proximate cause, of causation, that you can link together.
They want to see real tangible damage of them.
Right. And the special damages are usually lost income, but not what you could have done with that income. You can go in and say, here's my lost income and what I didn't get as a result of working. But you can't say this is... that I would have, here's what I would have invested with my income, what I would have purchased, or how I could have lived. And so, Martin, it's another thing if during the time period this is going on, you're getting charitable money. People are just giving you money. You can't recover that. It has to be a loan because, you're not, the defendant gets the benefit of the charity of others that are given to a person. But if there's no requirement to pay it back.
Let's say for a person loses their house because they really don't have income, but they're unable to work and produce income, and they fall behind and the house is foreclosed upon, and they end up living in a cardboard box under a bridge somewhere.
Well, maybe.
Where's the threshold when it becomes tangible?
Okay, so it's all a causation argument, and sometimes you can have that introduced into evidence. Sometimes some judges won't let it come in, but some will. But the bottom line is, then the defense lawyer, the insurance defense lawyer, paid for by the insurance company, hired by the insurance company, stands up and says, so then, as Brad just made the excellent point, so then, sir, you could have, you say you could have lost money, and you could have invested money in the stock market, and you lost losses there. You could have made money in the stock market. You could have made money in more real estate. You could have made more money in speculation in real estate. You could have done this. You could have done that. So sure, you can testify about what it's done to you, but it becomes more remote. It becomes less causative. It's harder to connect the dots to the injury.
Those are like crystal ball damages.
Yeah, crystal ball damages, right.
Yeah. And there's some sense to say that's fair by saying it's easy for somebody to sit on a witness stand 2 or 3 years after their losses saying, well, if I had gotten the money and not had to spend it on the medicals that I had and all the other stuff, I would have invested in this or that or this and that. And I think that a lot of courts view that with a lot of suspicion as far as saying you're going to use your 2020 hindsight to say what exactly you would have been investing in. Who's to say you would have had any money left over anyway, or you would have had in a bad investment, you know? So it becomes a challenge to where I think the courts normally, normally don't allow it. They're not going to allow it to come in.
So they're not going to allow any kind of speculation like that?
Normally not. And whether or not that's true speculation is a question, but normally they're not going to.
But you know something else, Martin, as a corollary to that theory, if the judge says, I'm not going to let you testify about you losing your house, smart lawyers on the plaintiff's side would argue to the judge, well, okay, we're not going to claim that as an economic loss, but we're going to claim this as part of the emotional damages because this is part of the emotional injury that happened, and so there is part of that category of damages. And believe me, I have seen vicious arguments in court both ways. Thanks for the call, Martin.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care, buddy.
All right, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We're here for you. Today we're talking about the First Amendment. Glenn, we're going to get to you. Robert, we'll get to you. Larry, we'll get to you. We're going to answer your questions. You know the drill. We are injury attorneys in our day lives, in our radio lives. This is a law talk show. We're talking about the First Amendment, a fascinating amendment in our history. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show, championsofthepeople.com. Go there. A lot of information for you and our free books. We'll be right back. Welcome back. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show, the only show of its kind. Gary Bell, Brad Pollock. You know, we each have over 30 years of experience helping injured victims. That's what we do day by day. But right here on Saturday mornings, we're here for you. And if you have a call and we can't get to your call, we're here for you during the week. And Glenn, we're going to get to you. Robert, we're going to get to you. Larry, we're going to get to you. Right now, we're talking to Eric from Catlins. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. How are we doing today, guys?
Good.
Good.
Good. Well, listen, last week I had said we were on our last week of our lunch and breakfast special, but we've had so many requests. We're going to run it through the holiday one more week. That's going to be our breakfast special, the pumpkin French toast. We're using Texas toast. Got it in a pumpkin spice egg wash, and we're going to griddle that to a golden brown syrup with a side of syrup. People have asked for that all the time, so we're going to run one more week. And our lunch special that we're going to continue is our ham and Swiss croissant. That we're going to take a croissant, we're going to griddle it to a golden brown, and I've made up a mixture of honey Dijon mustard and brown sugar to put on there, ham and Swiss croissant. You can get our waffle cut fries for that or our homemade chips for a dollar more. That's the lunch special for one more week. And don't forget, on Mondays and Fridays from 11 to 2, we do an all-you-can-eat taco and burrito buffet. It's all-you-can-eat. It's only $7.99. That actually includes a non-alcoholic beverage in the price. That's really, really good, and that's picking up each week, getting more and more popular, so come check that out. And it looks like we're going to eke out one more weekend maybe of good weather, so the umbrellas are up. We've got bottomless mimosas for $10. We're taking advantage of that. So tons of reasons to come on down. And if that's not enough, we've got flat-screen TVs with all your college games on it. Come on down, have a good time, bring your friends, bring your dog, bring your kids. Everybody's welcome at Catlins.
Eric, what do you mean eke out one more week? We're going to have a number of weeks where we'll be...
I hope you're right. I really do. This is Colorado, so you don't know, but I'll take this weekend. I'll take whatever one I can get, absolutely.
Well, not only that, I've officially canceled winter.
There you go.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
The umbrella's up.
Yeah.
Are you going to have the Broncos on Sunday if we want to watch
them? Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Football
that game's at 2:05. We don't close till 3. You can come in, get a drink, sit out back, sit in there and watch the game. Here we go. Go Broncos.
All right, buddy.
All right, Eric, where are you located?
Okay, we're at 4379 East Mississippi Avenue. Now, that's one block east of Colorado Boulevard, and that's in the Glendale Shopping Center, guys.
All right, Eric, thanks. Yeah, Catlins Restaurant, you'll love it every bite of the way. Right now, join us live on the air. KHOW is Glenn from Golden. Good morning, Glenn. How are you?
Morning. Good. How are you guys?
Good.
I'm driving, so I'll just get you real quick. What's the statute of limits on the fraud upon the court?
Statute of limitations is normally a 3-year statute of limitations. When you say fraud upon the court, though, what do you mean by fraud upon the court?
Well, a friend of mine had a public administrator that lied to his lawyer, and then the lawyer, they conspired. He hired an investigative reporter, and they're doing a documentary on the public administrator's office in Jefferson County, but he wants to recover his dad's house if it's possible.
Well, when you're talking about fraud, that's a discovery statute. So when you start talking about what the statute of limitations is when you're talking about fraud, the first thing is it's 3 years from the date that you discover the fraud, or it should have been discovered. Okay.
Right.
Now, when you say lie upon the court, when you start talking about public administrators or people deliberately lying to the court, there can be other penalties that the person who committed the lie can face from the court for really lying to the court as a form of contempt of court when you're a lawyer, when you're supposed to be.
Well, he has a lawyer that's talking about a RICO. I guess they sued one public administrator for a RICO, so they want to go after this one. And he said that he's an out-of-state lawyer, but he said that his damages will be, his fees will be paid, and they get three times the guy's damages.
That's correct.
But some of the damages is mental stress, like the last caller. It was like wanna, coulda, shoulda stuff.
Well, you know, once again, the first damages they're going to try and do is they're going to be talking about what's the they're going to want to be talking about what's the actual damage that you can relate dollars out of pocket. Those are usually called special damages. And special damages are the money that you have out of pocket or money that you didn't receive that you should have received or money.
But all this can apply to probate court, or is that just for other courts? Is probate court by itself?
Oh no! The probate court handles estate actions, but that's not going to stop, and that doesn't forgive anybody for lying or for causing damage or causing injury. And the action probably won't be handled within the probate court, but if it doesn't, it can be moved over to a civil case because a civil RICO is one who that you can also do in a civil case or in a civil court. Normally, a probate court is a civil court that's handling probate actions, unless you're in Denver. Denver has its own probate court, but most of the time, the courts throughout the jurisdictions in this state, most of those courts will handle probate courts in addition to the civil. Now, I should say Adams County and Jefferson County and Arapahoe County also have what they call probate courts. But those judges will send the civil action over to the civil court and wait to hear what the response is.
Well, Glenn, I got to tell you, and we're talking about a general statute of limitations, and Brad's right, it's a discovery statute of limitations, which means it starts to run from the time that you either discovered or should have discovered the injury. But what I want to say to you is there are many nuances and exclusions and exceptions to what we just said on the general statute of limitations.
Correct.
For example, if you had a trial and you're going to have fraud on the court, you have 6 months to file a motion for a new trial, for newly discovered evidence. For example, you've got other limitations against municipalities. And so what we're talking about is general today, and we can't really drill down to the very specifics because it just is ad infinitum. I mean, there's many, many parameters there.
Sure, and I think a RICO is actually a four-year statute of limitations from the federal court. I think the U.S. Supreme Court determined that in a case called Rotel.
Have you ever heard of anything like that before in the Colorado area, the metro area?
Of what?
Public administrators being charged with RICO civilly?
You know, I haven't heard of being charged with RICO, but I know there was a lot of turmoil going on in the Jefferson Court over a number of probate questions and a number of questions with respect to public administrators not properly handling probate courts. I think that also extended into Arapahoe, and I think there were a number of
Well, I heard that one of the Arapahoe counties was sued civilly, and it was settled out of court.
That's possible. But remember, a show or two ago on this station right here, we did a show, and somebody asked us about immunity questions, and you know, judges are immune; they have judicial immunity. And so, when you get into maybe the public administrator, you get into what's called a quasi governmental immunity situation. So, the bottom line is this, Glenn: those kind of questions you're asking are specifically, intensively fact driven. And there has to be a specific analysis of the exact facts, the officials you're going to go after, how you're going to sue them, the precise fraud, where it was committed, and those sort of things. And so that's really, really the way attorneys go at it on your type of question.
I know one was brought in Arapahoe County against an attorney by the name of Tamara Palmer. Now, I know that case got dismissed, but I can't remember why. I'd have to look at it to get a little more information. I remember it was Judge Sylvester who I think dismissed it, and I don't remember the opinion or whatever, but I know that
no, it's filed in Denver. It wasn't Judge Sylvester. It was the RICO case was filed in Denver.
Yeah, I was gonna say I don't think that was a RICO case that was being even carried out at that point. It was it was the Gormley case, and Tamara Palmer was involved. But how that What was the reasoning and what was going on, and if it was refiled and what had happened?
It was state litigation is what they were saying, that the lawyers conspired with each other and pretended they were fighting each other and then billing the estate.
Yeah, and I remember also, if I remember right, some of that came up in a
that's ridiculous
in Jefferson County, another case. If
that's
I remember,
ridiculous.
I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous. Two lawyers to get together, if assuming that's true, and conspire just to fight to run up the bills. That's ridiculous. To get, you know, that shouldn't
it
happen.
Be ridiculous, yeah, but it's profitable.
Yeah, profitable, right? But yeah, I mean, your point's well taken. That shouldn't happen. There should be redress, and there should be justice on the situation. Again, I'm going to say it's fact-driven, and so do you know what the ultimate result was?
On which case?
On the attorneys, the two attorneys that you said conspired with each other to drum up and run up the fees on the estate.
I know the attorney that sued him, and I heard her attorney insurance fund paid it off to make it go away is what I heard.
I see.
Yeah, and I think that's why it was dismissed. But if I remember right, before that all happened, Sylvester required Palmer and Gormley to
that was because the Post brought out an article by Olinger about how they were staged in litigation and they bought a building together and they didn't disclose it.
Yeah, and he wanted but disclosure of all.
It's a lot more intertwined.
Yeah, he wanted disclosure of all the cases that they were on together, and he wanted to know look into all the cases where the two of them had any involvement where they were both on the same case. Now, like I said, how that ended out being what was happening, if I remember right, that was the Lewis estate that was involved, and it was about $2 million in assets that got depleted.
Yeah.
So we might be talking about different cases, but yeah. So, you know, as Gary said, the statute can be different, but I think a RICO is 4 years. If you have a friend, though, if you have somebody who is looking into this, it sounds like he's already got an attorney that's taking care of it. If not, have him call our office and we'll get him hooked up with the appropriate people to make sure that there's immediate action taken to make sure that he doesn't lose his statute.
Hey, Glenn, that was a great call. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Gary Bell, Brad Pollock. This is a Law Talk Show, 303-713-8255. Eric, Robert, Larry, we're going to get to you after the break. Go to our website, championsofthepeople.com. If you want any of our free books, you can download an ebook there. Don't forget about our book, Cowards of the Street, Hit and Run, like if you're hit on your bicycle by a car if they leave, or if they stay, there's insurance questions that are involved. We'll be right back. Welcome, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We are injury attorneys in our day lives right here on the radio. We're here for you. Telephone number is 303-713-8255. And don't forget about the show that follow our show, the Consumer Real Estate Show, Barry and Larry. Very professional. If you've got any questions on real estate, I mean, if you're buying a house, you might have an inspection question, HVAC question. What do you do with inspections? What do those contract provisions mean? And how do you help yourself and protect yourself? The Barry and Larry Show, Consumer Real Estate Show, is for you. Right now, we're going to talk to Robert. Good morning, Robert. You want to talk about slander?
Well, I'll tell you, there's almost no time left. I had a whole bunch of subjects. I was wondering, maybe you guys could give out your home phone number so people could plant the seeds of conversation a week or two early.
Seriously.
I'm just kidding.
If my actions of canceling winter are okay, I'll give you my, if they work, I'll give you my home phone number then.
No, I'll never do that.
All right. What's up?
How about billboard censorship and sandwich boards and newspaper censorship? Oh, my goodness, freedom of speech. I don't think that exists anymore. Even letters to the editor edited by the editor in his opinion as to what should be printed.
Well, the interesting thing about editorials is people say, well, you know, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't publish that. You shouldn't, no matter what newspaper it is. But and then you should be more objective, and you should give equal time and equal space to somebody else. But there's been all kinds of case law that says that's what editorials are. They're opinions, and they don't have to give equal time and space to somebody else. But what you just talked about on billboards is labeled under commercial speech. Commercial speech is different. Commercial speech can be regulated by the local levels, state, municipality, government levels. It can be. Commercial speech is different than just, quote, as we know in the law, called free speech. And so you can, whereas you could not, under certain circumstances, regulate free speech of an individual, you can, meaning the government can regulate to a certain extent commercial speech.
In regard to an election, I mean, what if there's more money in the election and they plaster billboards everywhere? I mean, for a general election, let's say, for example, what's coming up.
Okay, well, that's in a different category. We're talking about political speech, and that's where it gets really complicated, because that's not just selling a product as defined by commercial speech. A lot of people could argue they're selling a product, but...
They're selling an agenda, really.
Right, they're selling an agenda, but it's different than advertising XYZ game or XYZ TV or something like that. So that's commercial speech. But, yeah, I mean, and becomes more liberal as to what you can say and do when you become into the political arena, as we all know.
So, hey, if that one guy, Larry, is listening, if that's the right Larry, I'm going to give up my time to him. He's smarter than I am.
Okay, well, we'll tell Larry. Thanks for the call, Robert.
Okay, you bet. See you guys.
Hey, Robert, we'll talk more about this next week on all this stuff.
Good for you. So. This is a wide-open subject.
No problem. Thank you. All right, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Gary Bell, Brad Pollock, we're here for you. We're going to try to take your calls in the order in which they have come in. So we're going to talk to Larry. Good morning, Larry. How are you?
Good morning. I want to thank Robert for his kind gesture. I don't know if I'm the right Larry, but I appreciate his gesture.
Well, hey, your name is Larry, so if the round peg goes in the round hole, it fits. Let's go.
Take it.
I will take every compliment I can get.
Okay.
Guys, I'm calling because, number one, my other insurance company is pretty conservative. This past year, I've had a couple of bad luck with car accidents. Not TWIs, nothing like that, just hitting a pole, that kind of thing. Well, recently, I had an accident while I was with a rental car while I was on a trip. And my understanding is that if I put this claim with my insurance company, they will drop me. I understand that. So right now I'm trying to negotiate, with the rental company to see if I can work something out. My question is, at the same time, I'm also looking at another company to make a switch to another insurance company. My question is, if I decide to put in a claim after I switch to another insurance company, my current insurance company be obligated to pay that claim? How does it work? And secondly, if I switch to another insurance company before this whole thing is settled, will I be committing anything illegal or fraud, anything like that?
It's pretty much going to be the insurance company that's on the hook is the insurance company you had at the time of the accident. If you switch insurance companies, it doesn't matter. You know, I've had a number of people, they haven't been happy with the way their insurance companies handled things, and they've wanted to change insurance companies. They want to know, will my insurance company still be there for the underinsured? No, the insurance company that's on the hook at the time of the accident, it doesn't get off just because you change insurance companies. And the new insurance company does not buy the past problems. All they get is what comes up after you've switched companies. So, you shouldn't have a problem with... If you want to change, if you're not happy with the insurance company, go ahead and change.
The other part of the answer, Larry, is people need to know that there's basically two divisions to insurance coverages. One's called an occurrence policy, and one's called a claim policy. And so what you're talking about usually is an occurrence policy, meaning the insurance company that was covering the incident at the time of the occurrence is the one that has to be responsible. Other types of insurance, sometimes like professional malpractice insurance for doctors, et cetera, can be made on a claim basis. So it's not when it occurred, the event occurred, it's when the claim is made. The claim may not be made for a year and a half after the event. So it really depends on whether it's an occurrence policy. But most car policies and what you're describing are occurrence-based. At the time of the event, all rights are fixed. The insurance coverage is fixed. And that's the way that goes. But I want to address another part of your question. I want people to understand, if you ever talk to insurance experts, if you ever talk to bad faith insurance experts, and they all say pretty much the same thing, the common thread is, if you have a claim that you want to file on your house, on your car, or anything like that, anything like property, you need to make sure it's a substantial claim. If you had a sliding glass door in your house broken, many experts, I'm not saying this is my opinion, but many experts will say don't file the claim because these claims are then counted against you. Can you be canceled on your first claim? Maybe, but they're going to count against you. And then if you go to another insurance company, they're going to take that information and submit it to a central database, so you're not going to fool the next insurance company. You're not going to go to ABC Insurance Company, new insurance company, and they're not going to know. They're going to know you filed a claim. And so make sure it's a substantial claim. Like when your roof is destroyed, that's a substantial claim. Make the claim.
Yeah. Guys, always great advice. Thank you so much.
Take care, buddy.
Okay, we appreciate your call, Larry. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show, we're here for you every Saturday. We're going to talk to Gerald right now. Good morning, Gerald. Welcome to Bell and Pollock.
Good morning.
What can we do for you?
I had a question about disability.
Yes, sir.
Is it possible to reopen a settled claim if the circumstances change later on?
Okay, what kind of claim was it? A car accident claim or?
It was a back injury where I was working.
A workers' comp claim?
It went through the insurance. Yeah, I guess it was workers' comp.
Well, you know, I was going to tell you that, no, you couldn't reopen one, but in a workers' comp, you might be able to reopen.
You sure might be able to.
You know, how long ago was your claim settled and what? And
it was, I was injured in 2007, and it was a physical job, and in 2008, I got a different job that didn't have the physical requirements, and so I was back at work.
Right.
And I settled in 2010, and by 2011, my condition had deteriorated further, and I became completely disabled in 2007, and I'm now classed as totally and permanent, 2013.
Okay, so Gerald, you're dealing with a workers' comp situation that's a different flavor, a different animal than an automobile accident. If you settle an automobile case, you sign a release, and it's probably over with permanently. You might have a shot at this, but we're up against the wall on time, so give Kevin your information. We're going to have one of our work comp experts give you a call and this week, and we'll see if we can solve your problem for you.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm going to put you on hold, Gerald, and thank you very much for the call, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We're here for you every week. Bell and Pollock, go to our website, championsofthepeople.com. It's an information-loaded website. If you want any of our free books, Cowards of the Street, another book, Don't Get Hurt Twice in the Same Accident, Once in the Accident, and again on the insurance claim, and our workers' comp book, we're there for you. Champions of the People. We'll be right back. The way the moonlight shined upon her head.